Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore. It's another episode. And oh, honestly, this episode is cracking. I sit and talk to Ali Cook, and when I got the song list sent over up front, I knew it was going to be interesting. I did not think we would be talking ninjutsu. I did not think we would be talking BMXing and magic. This podcast goes everywhere, and we just had a wonderful chat, and I really can't wait for you to hear it. Before we get on with that chat, can I just make a few thank yous? I want to thank my bud Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast, and thanks to you lot for continuing to support the podcast, listen and send me nice messages and do the little shares and the tweets and the retweets and all of that. It really helps. So thanks loads for just being bloody nice. Also, if this is your first time listening, when you get to the end of today's chat with Ali, then go and explore the back catalogue, because there's 360 odd episodes now. You can hear me talking to artists as diverse as Chuck D, to Fatboy Slim, to Motley Crue, to the Foo Fighters, to Idols, Suede, Sleaford Mods. Oh gosh, the list goes on. Loads of comedians: James Acaster, Ed Gamble, Maisie Adam, Jade Adams, producers like Butch Vig. Oh god, who else? What haven't I spoke about? Actors: Maxine Peake, Manda Abington, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose, Michael Smiley. Oh, there's loads. Go and have a rummage in that archive. If that's not enough for you, go check out my Patreon, where you get access to loads of radio shows, video episodes, unreleased episodes, oh, all sorts of goodies. And that costs you 79p a month. 20p a week. Wow. Come on. Right. You can find out about all of this and more at your one-stop shop, www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beat and Track Podcast with Ali Cook. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now, and you may have heard me talking about the products from the cacao bar, and there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to, and all you've got to do is, just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we are recording. Ali, how are you today?
I'm good, yeah. Are you okay?
I'm all right. Whereabouts are you today?
I'm in my home in Hampstead, North London.
Lovely stuff. Before we start talking records, I want to talk about home and generally being stuck at home over the last however many months it's been now. we're recording this on the 15th of October, so we're out of lockdown and normal life has resumed somewhat. But I just want to cast your mind back, really, and just tell me a little bit about how you found the last sort of 16 months during lockdown, how you found that both personally and creatively.
Oh, that is a good question. Well, it's a weird one for me because I am a self-employed performer. So the idea of never seeing anyone for weeks on end is quite a common experience. So to be honest, on some levels, it was business as usual with no work coming in. But it was a very unusual time. I mean, there was quite a lot happening with me. I actually lost my mum over that period.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
It wasn't due to COVID, but it was quite a tough time. However, it also meant I could spend a lot of time with her, you know, because we had more time because we weren't running around everywhere. And then in terms of sort of, I write a lot. So sort of creatively, I sort of threw myself into writing a new idea for a sitcom, actually. And then also because I do comedy as well, I was doing online shows, which are the weirdest thing ever known to man. Because basically, these sort of corporate jobs, you get hired and then they just switch everyone onto mute. So you have no idea if people are laughing or you're dying. You have no idea.
I had Maisie Adam on, and she said she'd done one of them outdoor ones where you're in your car where you hoot your horn if you're laughing. That's surreal, isn't it?
That was I know who was doing those. That was a guy called Brett Vincent, who's a very known comedy promoter, and he'd taken over one of those sort of drive-in cinemas. It was an ingenious idea, but yeah, you're storming it if everyone's beeping the horn.
It's such an aggressive sound as well, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, that's not reassuring, is it? Oh, that was good.
Oh dear. But the thing, I guess back then we were so thirsty for anything that was close to what we'd usually do. And if that was going to comedy, you'd take what you could get, and there was people doing gigs in that kind of scenario as well. And what a bananas time. So
absolutely crazy time. But everyone sort of developed an online act.
Yeah.
And one thing that it was quite good for was I always thought it was quite good. I did quite a lot of courses and stuff as well to fill my time. And I feel like Zoom and things are actually excellent for learning.
Oh, my God.
Really cool. I do think that's a good thing, actually.
Well, up until lockdown, I mean, don't get me wrong, I wish just before lockdown I would have heard about Zoom and definitely bought shares in it. But it was one of them things. Up until then, I'd go to a studio in London. I'd try and arrange to get the guests to have time to come and sit. All of a sudden, this kind of Zoom thing, which the first few times I recorded like this was like surreal. I was like, this is weird. I've not got that kind of ambience you get in when you're in a room with somebody talking. It was like, it felt very strange. But quite quickly, I think we all adapted, didn't we, doing bloody quizzes and God knows what. And what it's done is it just opened it up. I think like I've spoke more to my extended family that live overseas than I ever have. And it's meant that this podcast has meant I can speak to people all over the world now rather than guests that happen to be in London on this certain time.
Certain day. Yeah. You know, it suddenly changed it all, didn't it? Certainly in the work environment, definitely as well. Yeah. It's no longer seen as like, kind of cool, like the only the cool kids were doing it. It's like everyone suddenly was just doing it. Yeah. It seemed very normal. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, does that mean that we are in with the cool kids now then?
I like to think so, yeah.
Wonderful. I'm having that alias gun on the CV, mate. Let's talk records. For track one, mate, I'm going to ask you please to tell me the song that you think's got the greatest ever intro, please.
Okay, so I have to point out I was obsessed with hip-hop as a child, and I think the song with the best intro of all time is a song called Beat Bop by K-Rob and Ramel Z, who turned out to be quite a famous artist in later years. And the reason I think it's the best intro ever, there was a documentary on TV years ago called Subway Art, which is when graffiti first started in New York. And then every Monday morning, all these pieces would suddenly appear on the subway trains. And the promo to that documentary, which blew my mind as a 12-year-old, was the start of this song playing as these trains were leaving and going around the city of New York. And I just thought it was this sort of slow, it was a slow beat that really encapsulated everything of how cool New York was at that time and how cool hip hop as a new sort of form of music was. So that was it.
And I mean, it's that 808 drum sound, isn't it? That's glorious. And I'm 48, and I was probably just into secondary school when hip hop happened.
Yeah.
And there was one copy of Subway Art in our local library, the book.
Right, yeah.
And everybody, it was like pre-booked, like for like months in advance. And playtime, you know, like any break at school, we would all be crowding around the one kind of slightly spoilt kid that had a copy of Subway Art.
Yeah.
And we'd all be looking like desperately trying to get to see graffiti, because nowadays, obviously, you can see everything whenever you want. But back then, like, and the same with hip hop as well, you could only get what certain, you know, maybe pirate stations or Radio London were playing, and you couldn't really get, you'd get occasional tracks that break through and you might see them on Top of the Pops, but you had to really search for any scraps of hip hop back then.
Yeah, you did. And so I lived in Harrogate in Yorkshire, and me and my brothers, every Saturday, we used to get the train to Leeds. And there was a shop called Crash Records in Leeds, which was a kind of a real record shop for DJs. And they would get imports in. And there was another shop called Jumbo Records. And so we used to go there. And we would spend 30 quid on a 12-inch or an album. And like, I remember buying NWA as on import. And I was like, who are these crazy guys? And then I remember playing it, and then my mum and dad thinking, oh my God, the lyrics. You got to remember, I lived in a tiny village in the middle of nowhere. So it was this huge juxtaposition, sort of being into hard rap music whilst living basically on a farm, you know, in the middle of nowhere.
But I think one of the things that really appealed about all of that was the fact that it was so different to what we had in the UK. And
it was,
everything they were singing about and the fashion and everything just seemed very exciting. And that kind of period in the 80s, everything was very focused on the States, wasn't it? And films and kind of fashion. Yeah. And it just felt super exciting. And I mean, you mentioned NWA then. And I remember like kind of hearing like Ice-T and NWA and Public Enemy and stuff like that, and just thinking, wow, this is like really aggressive and angry, and my parents, you know, they think it's vile. And with that in mind, I kind of think that for my generation, like, hip-hop was kind of our punk.
I think it was, actually. Yeah, I think it was. And but it also, I thought, you know, I was 12 listening to Public Enemy, and it actually taught you quite a lot about the world, because, you know, hip hop back then was very socially conscious. And I kind of made me a better person, actually. You actually learned a lot about racism, etc. That, you know, growing up in a little town in the middle of nowhere, I'd have no idea what was going on in the world at all. I think it definitely was punk for our generation, no doubt about it. Yeah. And also, it was just incredibly cool. Like, that, you know, Subway Art was an amazing documentary.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it blew my mind, you know. And everyone I knew, I was going to say, with Subway Art, we used to try and trace the letters.
Yeah.
And then copy the letters and then try and do our own pieces. But we'd stolen all the letters from the book and then just invented our own name.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, for track two, I'm going to take you back. And I'm going to ask you, please, Ali, to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Okay, so this is quite a left turn at the traffic lights. So the first song I remember having an emotional impact on me was One Man Band by Leo Sayer. Now, that is quite a leap from Beatbop. But my mum and dad, they were heavily into the Beatles, heavily into Leo Sayer. And my mum liked Eric Clapton as well. But I would say, and Simon and Garfunkel. So those were the soundtrack of my mum and dad's cars whenever we were going anywhere. And I remember being in the car, like maybe 6 or 7, hearing the Beatles. Oh, my mum also liked Blondie as well. And then also hearing Leo Sayer. And it was the song One Man Band that just really hit me. And I think it's the bit when he's talking about the rain coming down. And that sort of resonated with me years later performing at the Edinburgh Festival, when it's like a Tuesday night and you're trying to sell out. And then suddenly it just rains for 6 hours. And then you're just like, oh, there's going to be like no one in. And you've spent all year working on this show. And that really sort of hit me as sort of how brutal it can be being a performer. And then the other thing I love about Leo Sayer is he's kind of nuts, but also incredibly talented. Like, and very overlooked, just an incredible songwriter. And was it Roger Daltrey he wrote that song for, I think, originally, and then he sung it himself later on.
For Roger Daltrey, really?
I think so, yeah, yeah. And you can just see the talent. You can, you know, I'm not a musician, but you could just see this sort of crazy talent to come up with a track like that. And then also from a hip-hop standpoint, I always thought the drum beat could be sampled. Yeah. and I'm amazed no one... like Puff Daddy ever sampled. Yeah. That's like the only track he never sampled that would have been great.
Do you think that's like a kind of a byproduct of growing up in the generation you did, that and having a love of hip hop? Do you think that kind of tweaks the way that you hear anything groove based now? And do you still think, oh, there's a yes. lovely little sample there?
There were a couple of things that got me like that. So I used to. There was this a rap group in Leeds called Breaking the Illusion, and they actually got into the charts. They got to about the early 30s, like 34, 35, and they'd sampled Golden Brown. And this was a guy who worked in a clothes shop in Leeds, a guy called Paul, who was like a mate of ours. And we just loved the fact that he'd sampled Golden Brown. And then we really got into sampling. So I had Cubase, and we used to just go and buy, you know, they used to call it rare grooves. So yeah. We used to buy people like James Brown, Led Zeppelin. And then that's when I started to realize what good musicianship is, you know, like the drum beats from the drummer in James Brown, like in the Funky Drummer, or Led Zeppelin's drummer. You just suddenly understand, oh, this is genuinely brilliant music.
Yeah.
Or the drumming of, say, Phil Collins. He's like, oh, my God, these guys are incredible. And then the hip hop producers, they weren't idiots. They genuinely went to the world's best musicians and sampled their stuff. Mm. And then also you just start looking for it. Yeah. You sort of pick it up. And I always thought that was one of those tracks where if the right guy got hold of it, they could have done a really good song out of it. Yeah.
So what, you was messing around with Cubase yourself, like doing
I was terrible at it. I was just like, it was on an Atari ST.
Oh, wonderful.
And just had no instructions. It was a sort of a final, at this time, I would have either have gone into music or general performing. In the end, I went into performing because I just didn't really, I didn't have access to, say, like a music college or anything up in Yorkshire, really, at that time. But yeah, I used to, you know, try and make little samples and little tracks and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
Did you see I think it's such an art form, and the way that you say, you know, oh, you just found someone else's record and then found that little moment in it, and you know, you sample it and loop it, and that's such an art form, and that, you know, that should never be looked at like that. That's just
no,
creaming off of someone else's talent. That to find that and to use that correctly is such an amazing art form. And I don't know if you ever seen the documentary they made about 4 or 5 years ago on Public Enemy, and they've got the 808 where the bomb squad are there, and then all of a sudden they hear Eric B and they're like, oh, there's a new thing happening here, sampling, what's this all about? And like, and Harry just revolutionized and completely changed hip hop, you know? It's like,
isn't it when was it Chuck D and his producer heard "I Know You Got Soul" by Eric B and Rakim, and they were like, oh my god, we've got to get better. I think that sampling's a little bit like the people who make trailers for movies. So like, you know, say you're suddenly landed the latest Star Wars film, how do you condense all of that great imagery into 2 minutes where people are going to go, Jesus, this is the best film ever, I've got to see it. And I sort of think that the people who can sample stuff, that's a similar ability. Definitely. It's not easy at all. And Public Enemy, I mean, sort of tracks like Welcome to the Terrordome, something like that, the sampling within that and the amount of sampling within that is incredible.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
It's a shame because it does mean that some bands that never cleared them samples means you can't get to listen to De La Soul on Spotify.
Oh, is that why? That's the reason.
I think 3 Feet High and Rising, I think so much of it was never cleared. So, which is a shame because it's one of the greatest hip hop records ever made. But I think maybe you can hear maybe Magic Number, but or Say No Go.
But that was the reason why I didn't, because I didn't know that. That was, because I was trying to find De La Soul, and I was glad I kept the old CD, actually.
What a record.
Yeah.
Okay, standing the formative years for track three, I'm going to ask you please to tell me about the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Yeah, so this, I mean, there's thousands of songs I could choose, but the song that reminds me of my school days is Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is really my sixth form years. And this is the year where everyone discovers partying, girlfriends, boyfriends, and drinking. And I remember this was when Nirvana was just, or maybe a year or two after Nirvana were out, actually. But it was just one of those anthems.
Yeah.
Other anthems that time would be, the other one I was tempted to say was Insane in the Brain by Cypress Hill, or Sit Down by Blur, when everyone used to sit down on the dance floor. In Harrogate, there was this really manky pub where everyone used to have their 17th or 18th birthday parties, and it was a right dive, and everyone went down into the basement, and there was just like the cheesiest looking discotheque, and all they ever played were these tracks. And it was someone else's party every other weekend. And it was just like really dingy, but we all loved it. And it's sort of that grunginess of Nirvana reminds me of that venue, actually. And when I first started sort of going out.
Oh, it's a wonderful intro as well.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know that record happens when it drops because it is monumentous. I think the producer described it as when Dave Grohl's drums kick in, it feels like you're in a house made of bricks collapsing on top of you. And I think, yeah, that pretty much sums it up. Well, tell me about school, Ali. How was it? Mm-hmm. And where was it?
I was very ill as a child. I was off school a lot. And so I went to three schools because of that. So originally I grew up in Harrogate in Yorkshire. I went to St. Peter's originally, which was a brilliant school, but I got very ill. And so then my mum sent me to a private school to sort of catch up, which was a school called Brackenfield, which was sort of hilariously posh. And that was in the Duchy area of Harrogate, which was like the posh part of Harrogate. And then after that, I went to the Harrogate Grammar School, and which was, a state school, but a very, very good state school. And I was always one of those people where I had loads of hobbies that were far more important than my schoolwork. But I did all right at school. But every school report was always, of course he can do it, he just can't be bothered. And that was because at the time, well, firstly, I was a professional BMX racer. Then I got into martial arts. And then I wanted to be a ninja. And then I got into magic. So I had these incredible obsessive hobbies that sort of overtook everything, basically.
It's so weird. It's like, as a young kid, BMXing just was the most exciting thing I could ever imagine. And I had this moment when tail end of the 70s, very early 80s, where I'd had a rally boxer. And I had my eyes set on the next one up. I was going to go for the Rally Grifter. And I was like, I'm going to get a Grifter. And top boy in my estate. And I remember going to the bike shop and this guy going to me, look, if your dad's going to spend that amount on you, this thing's called a BMX. You should get one of them. And I was like, how many gears has it got? And he went, none. I was like, leave off. Like, I'm having this Grifter, mate. Fast forward about 4 or 5 months. Fuck me. All of my mates are doing these amazing jumps and stunts, and I've got this cast iron Grifter stuck in red gear and going nowhere fast, desperately regretting not having a BMX. I was like, oh, I can't have stunt nuts on a Grifter. It looks shit.
In fact, when you said that about gears, I remember years later with my BMX. And you would say to your other mates, you were like, what, your bike's got gears? That was a problem. Like, right, okay, yeah. Because I'm just a few years younger than you, so sort of my first serious bike was a BMX, actually, and it was a rally. The first one I ever got was a rally. I can't remember the name of it. It was red and yellow with yellow pads on it, and it weighed a ton.
Not the burner. It wasn't a rally burner, was it?
Yeah, it was a rally burner. Was a rally burner, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so that was my very first BMX, and we'd seen BMXing on TV, and then my brother got one, and then that was it. He got a diamond back.
Oh, mate, was he more spoiled?
No, but then I came back in. Yeah, they were an exceptional bike. So he got one of those. And then there was a guy called Nick who ran a BMX shop in Harrogate. And then we started racing. And then I got what's called a Jag, but they went bust and they were taken over by a company called CW. And I had the small CW bike that literally weighed about 9 pounds. Even I could lift it up with one hand. I had 1-in-1/8 wheels, so I had racer wheels from a racer on a BMX for racing. So I was sort of too young to do freestyle because I didn't have the strength yet.
Yeah.
But I was a racer, yeah. And I did it all around the Northeast, really, for most of my childhood, really.
Oh, it was so exciting. I remember, I live near a big skate park in Romford that was very famous for for skating and BMXing, and our local hero Craig Campbell, he was golden boy of BMXing.
That was it. Yeah, gosh, I know, I remember that name. Yeah,
and yeah. And then you mentioned, I mean, again, like the age difference between us is so mad that, like, for me, I'd seen The Karate Kid and I wanted to learn karate, and like so many other kids, I learned karate. Fast forward a couple of years, there was this influx of ninja films, and all of a sudden, everyone wanted to be a ninja.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm so sort of obsessive when I get into something that I can't. I mean, the only thing I never really did is I never really was that into normal sport. Like, I played football and rugby and stuff, but I was never that into it. I was always more into these fringe things. But is it something like Golan Globus or something? And they did Revenge of the Ninja, American Ninja. Ninja 3, The Domination was the other one. And then there was the Chuck Norris ones.
Mm.
And then in Harrogate, there was this obscure video shop that got all of the worst dubbed martial art films. And the company was called Golden Harvest Productions. And they were like, the dubbing was terrible, but the people who made them were basically martial artists.
Yeah.
And they really did kung fu, but they all dressed as ninjas. Mm-hmm. And my middle brother, Jonathan, and then a friend from school, Danny, and another guy called Brendan, we all did karate together, and then we all did other martial arts. And there was a guy who set himself up who taught ninjutsu, apparently, and we studied it. And then every year he used to bring a guy over from Japan, and we used to do their courses, basically. I mean, I was massively nerdy. Like, I can't, like, there's no other way of explaining it, really. But yeah, I was obsessed with ninjas, obsessed.
Oh, they were
yeah.
the coolest things, weren't they?
I mean, yeah, they were so, it's as if it was made up, but they really were a real thing. It's like, they wore all black, they looked cool, they had these crazy weapons.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a guy called Stephen K. Hayes who wrote books on ninjas.
Mm.
And I used to get his books. And he was all like, how to use the environment to hide from the enemy.
Amazing. The fact you're wearing a black roll neck now makes me think any given moment you're going to just drop a smoke bomb and disappear. And like, but I mean, I was definitely one of them kids that we had a martial arts shop in Basildon.
Yes.
That I would go to, and I would save my money up and buy like a throwing star and then spend like hours throwing it in my garden fence.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
We had a
shop called Combat Sports in Leeds. And what I loved about the guy who ran it, he was like a former British champion of karate. And what was great about him, he would sell me, my brothers and my mates, anything we wanted. He was like, can I get this like chain for strangling people? Yeah, no worries. Can I have a few throwing stars? Yeah, no, not a problem. And the worst thing I ever got was, my mum took it off me. I got a ninja blowgun. And it was actually on TVAM a week later, and it was outlawed because it had these darts like this long. And even as a kid, I just went, like not even that strong. And it just went, boom. And it was absolutely deadly. And it was the coolest toy ever. But my mum said, no way.
Oh,
she was
man.
Like, this is just, I mean, it was a lethal. It was just a lethal bit of kit.
I'd give them my right arm for one of them when I was a kid. Meanwhile, I was probably like just endlessly hitting myself in my own nuts with my foam nunchuckers trying to learn.
Well, I had some nunchucks. I had mini nunchucks. My brother had full nunchucks.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I got, and I actually found it the other day because I put it on my Twitter, I bought a ninja grappling hook for 19 quid. And what we didn't realise is when you threw it over the branch, what we didn't realise is it would swing back.
Yeah.
So the amount of times you threw it over and it just went bang, just whacked you in the head.
I'm loving your level of commitment to being a ninja. You went all out.
Oh, we were, like, it was me, my middle brother, and then Danny, and then there was another guy called Charles Tomlinson, and we used to go down the woods dressed as ninjas. And yeah, we absolutely, at least for 3 or 4 years, we're absolutely obsessed with it. Yeah.
Oh, incredible. Yeah. Well, for track four, I'm going to ask you to tell me, please, the first song you remember buying from a record shop.
Yeah, so the first song I ever bought from a record store is Eric B for President by Eric B and Rakim. So this sort of is in the golden age of hip hop. And I was a little bit older now. So when I first started buying my own records, yeah, so maybe 13, 14. And actually, it was we used to go through to Leeds, but this was a record shop in Harrogate. And I just always remember, I think maybe we'd heard them on the radio or something. And then I just went and got the record and, you know, learned it all off by heart. That was the other thing. We used to just put it on at home and just listen to that same record over and over and over and over again until I got all the lyrics, basically. It was almost as though that's what we thought you did with rap music. We just thought that you sat at home and learned it, yeah, almost. And it was, of course, I didn't really know much about them at all. I think maybe a year or two later, they came out with Paid in Full, and then that's what made them famous, I think. Mm. And then they were on Top of the Pops and stuff like that. But yeah, that was the first record I ever bought. Yeah.
Normally, this is the one where people really embarrass themselves. You've gone in strong. That's a decent first record, isn't it? Super credible.
Yeah, I mean, that's on the sort of cool front. That's not bad, is it?
Picturing you with your little kind of like record bag, just walking out there dressed as a ninja, just getting on your BMX. Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, because normally it would be something like, it would be like a pop record, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was a cool thing about hip-hop, though, is when we say we got into sampling, it actually broadened our horizons. So you sort of started to realise that all music's good. It's just what genre you're into, you know. That was a great record, incredible record.
In those early years of sort of school and stuff like that, like, did you know what you wanted to be?
I knew what I wanted to be when I was about 16, 17. But prior to that, no, I was really into martial arts. Before that, BMXing. Me and my brother got decks. So we saved up. We were the only people. We rang around everywhere saying, do you have Technics 1200s? And I think it was Maplin's in Leeds ordered them for us. And then we went to it. There used to be a shop called Tandy, and we got a realistic mixer.
Yeah.
And then we had to get an electrician because we had no idea how to set up a proper amp. I didn't even know what an amplifier was. Mm. And we had that all going, but it was really so at that. So up until 15, I was just into stuff, but I didn't know what I wanted to be. But when it was a little bit longer, that's when I first started getting into magic. Which is, again, a totally nerdy hobby, but I could do it. For some reason, I could do it. And so I had this idea, either something to do with music or maybe magic. And then I think really what happened was I didn't have the access to know enough about music to really... If I'd have lived in London, say, I think maybe I'd have had more of an idea. But it was really at that point, when I was 17, I won this the British Championships for Magic. And then that's when I thought, oh, I can do this hobby as a living, is what I thought. So it was kind of at that age I thought I'll be a magician originally.
What an incredible life to that point. Magic, ninja, BMXer, and like turntablist. Amazing.
It really is like a... I suppose it's all the hobbies you saw on telly. Sort of ended up doing them. Yeah. And, but at the same time, I think I wasn't that good at ball sports. Like I was always all right at cricket or football, and I played it with my brothers and my friends, but I never, you know, like most boys love footy. Mm. It's just like, and my dad played for Leeds City Boys. Like, he was really, like, he had a real shot at it at one point. Yeah. But I don't know why. It's like, I'm never against it, but just never got me going. Yeah. Whereas these sort of nerdy hobbies. I love them. But to be honest, I think they all stem from being a ninja. Because I think even... Because, you know, ninjas were meant to be like masters of illusion.
Yeah.
So I think that that's also... That's also why I ended up getting to magic.
Oh, that's incredible. Oh, wow. I mean, in fairness, like, I'm with you. I was obsessed with martial arts and obsessed with hip-hop and music and... Mm. And, yeah, I didn't necessarily want to do what all the cool kids were doing. I was far more interested in them kind of cultures as well. And my mate had the realistic mixer. We couldn't afford the 1200s. He had, I don't even know if it was it a Tandy own brand? Citronic. We had two Citronic decks.
Two Citronic. If you had good slip mats, you'd be all right, I think.
That's right. Citronic. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Well, he went on. He went on to be the DMC world champ. So
seriously?
Yeah, yeah. And his name's what? DJ Destruction. And yeah.
Are you serious? Yeah. Oh, my God.
He started off with that exact mixer, and he's still got that mix. He doesn't use it anymore. But, yeah, he went on and he produced... He ended up producing the Chaos album for Adam F and worked on that album. He's just a lad from my hometown in Essex. And
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That record, he worked with LL Cool J, Busta Rhymes, M.O.P., Redman, Method Man, Guru, like... Yeah, he again.
Wow. I mean, I sometimes regret my choice. I sometimes think maybe because I did. Yeah, he's having that knowledge of sort of sampling and stuff at such a young age, and I used to know all the breaks. I often wondered.
Maybe
I should have gone down the music route.
Do you know what? He's the only person at my school as well that was a black belt. Unbelievable.
Was he a black belt as well?
Yeah, he was a black belt.
We'd have got on. We'd have definitely got on.
He would have been in your crew.
I got to brown belt.
And then... I got to brown belt. Was it second Q? There were three brown belts.
Oh, okay. Yes, there were. Yes.
I done Wadaroo. And yeah.
Me too. I did Wadaroo. Gosh. Yeah. Sports karate. Yeah.
That's it. Oh, wonderful. I'll tell you what, we always had white geese. And every time we go to competitions, and I was like this sort of tubby little sort of 14-year-old, and there'd always be like this one kind of like karate club that generally come from London, and they had black gis, and I just thought, wow, I do not want to get matched with one of them. A black gi, that just felt badass compared to like...
Yeah. It's a bit Cobra Kai, isn't it?
It was totally Cobra Kai. Oh dear. Okay, well look, let's move on a few years and I'm going to ask you about clubbing and for that, Ali, can you please tell me the song that soundtracked your years clubbing, please?
Yeah, so the track that was you know, really the anthem for my clubbing days was Space Cowboy by Jamiroquai. And I'm not sure who did that famous remix, but my God, that was the track that when that dropped, nightclubbing, mostly in Harrogate, actually, that was like the ultimate anthem.
Yeah.
Even years after it came out, I would say at least for 7 or 8 years, it was like I remember like moving to London for about 3 or 4 years, coming back up to Harrogate and going out, and they were still playing Jamiroquai because that was like the floor filler.
Yeah.
It was just an incredible record. And also at this time, I met a friend of mine called Jake McDonough, who was an incredible house DJ. He'd gone to a different school to me, but his ability to mix was like you have no idea when the track changed over. He was incredible. And I was like completely like a scratcher and then just drop it in. And I'd never seen DJing like this. And to be honest, I didn't like it. It really pissed me off for about 3 years. I was like, what is this? What is this crazy art form? And then at this point, I thought, I better get some house music and like learn to do what they're doing. And then in the end, we used to DJ together a bit. Not heavily so, but he mostly played house all night. And then I would do like an hour of hip hop in the middle sort of thing. But I just remember that... that it was always that Jamiroquai track that was always the one where the room went nuts, just went crazy. And I think one of the other reasons why it was such a good track was it was such a long intro.
Yeah.
For mixing. It was a perfect. It was probably 126 BPM. It was like perfect track to mix with.
Was you a big fan of clubbing?
Well, I was kind of really square, so... I never got into the whole like proper partying, drug taking. I was the guy who did the driving for everyone else because I was always like sober. So so I really loved it. I kind of loved dance music, particularly more from the sampling side of things. And we used to drive. I would drive everyone to Leeds. And then we used to go to a club called Hard Times and one called Mint. And I also saw Daft Punk right at the start of their first album.
Wow.
And it was for Leeds University. And I remember seeing them and it was all backlit with just these two guys behind all these monitors. And I was like, who are these guys? I've never heard. And they were the first people to sort of play slower house music, sort of using hip hop beats. And so I kind of loved the scene and I loved the music, but I was never into the crazy drug taking thing, to be honest. But I never ventured to like Manchester where the scene was massive.
Yeah.
I only ever drove through to Leeds basically. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to drive you back to Leeds and for track six. And I'm going to ask you to tell me, please, a favorite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Yeah, so a favourite song from a home county is Do I Want to Know by the Arctic Monkeys. And I chose this for a few reasons. One was I didn't want to snow you down with loads of obscure hip-hop references. the reason I like this track, it was the drums again. You know, when I heard the drumming, I was like, and the guitar riff, I was like, oh my God. And again, I was thinking this, if someone sampled this and rapped over it, it'd be immense. Yeah. By the time the Arctic Monkeys came out, I was a full-time performer on the comedy circuit. And I was actually at a university gig and this girl told me who they were. I'd kind of lost touch with music. All I did was gigs. Four nights a week at all around the country, and I was very out of touch with music, and she introduced me to them, and I loved that track so much that I did a West End magic show called Impossible, and I did this section in the show, you know, when people get in boxes and they disappear and they reappear all over the place. So it was me and three dancers, and we did the whole bit to this track. And so that's why I love that track so much, really, because it reminds me of that show.
So was there obscure Leeds-based hip-hop artists that would have been in the mix otherwise?
The obscure hip-hop artist was my friend Paul, and Breaking the Illusion, they genuinely got into the charts. They genuinely did it. They did quite well.
Wonderful.
And I think he runs some sort of radio station up in Leeds nowadays. So, yeah.
You mentioned, I mean, to do what you've done, you know, aside from the ninjutsu, but to then kind of put yourself into something like magic and then, you know, stand-up gigs, Would you say you're a confident person?
It's a good question that, because I remember doing the first time I did Edinburgh, the guy who did my lighting and stuff, he was like, oh my God, you're like, he first saw me on stage. And then when he met me afterwards, he goes, I just thought you were a super, super confident person. But I don't think most performers are that confident. It's just that you've learned a skill, and one of those skills is the illusion of confidence.
Yeah.
And also I've been on stage for a long time, a long time. I started doing shows sort of professionally when I was 16, 17. And so that I got used to what they call stage time. So the idea that I might be able to mix genres, you know, I started off obviously as a professional magician, but then the idea of me ending up performing in a comedy club, it was a leap, and it is terrifying, but it wasn't a massive leap because I'd already been doing corporate entertainment and stage shows since I was 16, 17. And the confidence just comes from sheer exposure, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I would say I'm a fairly confident person, but I also do get crippled by nerves before shows. Nowadays, it would be with a new show. An amazing amount of confidence is really repetition, to be honest. But the hard thing of a performer is when you do something brand new, to be honest. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can introduce someone to something brand new now. For the last track, I'm going to ask you please to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Well, I'm almost certain a lot of people won't know this, but I want people to hear this because I think this is a quintessential hip-hop track from the late 80s, early 90s. And this is called Holy War by Divine Force and Jazzy J. I first heard this because my brother had recorded it onto a cassette after hearing it on the radio. And I was playing this cassette randomly. And the two tracks that came on was Holy War and Gotta Have Your Love by Mantronics. These were these two tracks that I was absolutely obsessed with. One being Mantronics sort of breaking through into the mainstream. Mm. And then the other one being this, which was like the ultimate hip-hop song. And it's just this idea of sort of rhyming over a good sample. And then also the live scratching, because I think this is a live recording. But if you listen to the DJ and the sort of the rapper working in sync with each other, it's just quite amazing. And the only time I've ever seen anything else like this is only about 3 or 4 years ago, I saw KRS-One came over to Britain. And he did a little concert at the Jazz Cafe. And it was just that real old school rapping just over a breakbeat with his DJ just scratching up the tracks for real on a bit of vinyl.
Yeah.
Where to actually see those guys who were the masters of it, it was just amazing. Yeah.
Have you managed to get to many of them kind of Jazz Cafe shows where they bring over some of the legends? Did you see Big Daddy Kane a little while ago?
No, I didn't know he was there. Oh, my God. So I was a massive Big Daddy Kane fan, yeah.
I still think he's one of the best.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, it's unbelievable. But I think one of the nice things about being a performer generally is you learn to really appreciate other people in different art forms. And one of the things is actually seeing them at little gigs. That is... When I first started stand-up, I was middling, what they call middling, because the sweet spot in a comedy club is the middle spot, it's the easiest slot. And at the end of me, I was in a student night in Southampton, and they went, oh, now this guy coming on is Michael McIntyre, and I'd never heard of him. And he'd been going, at that point, probably 12 years or so. And to first see him in a small club, really rock a room, I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy's good.
Yeah.
And then it's the same, you know, I love going to little gigs, even if it's not the sort of thing I'm into.
Yeah.
Just seeing anyone who's exceptionally good. And, you know, KRS-One, it's like you might not be into hip hop, but Jesus Christ, can he rap? I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolute dude.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah.
Well, we put together a Spotify playlist, Ali, to accompany the podcast so people can go and listen to all of your selections. Hopefully the last ones on Spotify. I'll have to check.
And
we'll put on a few of the other tracks that we've also discussed on here. As we sort of start to edge towards the end of 21, hopefully in a far more open and connected manner than had a year started, what are you looking forward to personally from the rest of this year, and what's going to be happening professionally?
Well, I've been very lucky this year. I landed a great acting role in a new drama coming out called Ragdoll. And literally, I came out of lockdown, and in the acting world, you have to do all these self-tapes where you record yourself on your iPhone doing two or three scenes from a new TV series or whatever. And the poor casting directors, they send these out to literally hundreds of people, and the chances of getting picked are almost like a million to one. And I did one for this new drama, and it was so well written, but I didn't think much of it, but I actually got it, and I couldn't believe it. And then I started filming from March all the way until the end of August, and it's a new thriller coming out in November called Ragdoll, basically. And it's based on a best-selling thriller, and it's kind of a dark comedy thriller, basically. And I play one of the detectives in it. So that's the thing. I'm looking forward to seeing how they put it all together.
Oh, wonderful. And if people want to kind of keep up to speed with that and everything else that you're doing, where's the best place to follow you and keep up to speed with you?
It's probably on my Instagram, which is Ali_Cook.
Lovely. Ali, it's been an absolute joy chatting to you today.
It has been really, we would have definitely been mates.
I think so.
Literally separated by the M1.
Oh, honestly, mate, it's been a joy. I'll let you smoke your smoke bomb and disappear into the night now, mate. Thanks loads, Ali.
Cheers.
There you go. Oh, mate, literally disappeared in a cloud of smoke. Literally just his little hook and rope just left dangling. Pure ninja. Oh, mate, I had so much fun having that chat. Like I said at the beginning, no idea this was going to kind of move into the realms of chat that it did. And that's what I love about this podcast. You know, you kind of do your prep, you check your Wikipedias, and, you know, you do what you can and have a little rummage on YouTube to see what you can find out. And you just don't expect it to kind of take these tangents. And that's what's great. That's when, you know, the conversation really starts to roll, and you get a real snapshot of people. And this was one of those. It was an absolute delight. So thanks loads, Ali. Thanks to you lot for listening. As mentioned at the beginning, if you want to support the podcast, you can do that on Patreon, which is Patreon, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. If you can, that's great. It's about 20p a week, and for that you get access to another couple of hundred episodes and all the video episodes and radio shows and weekly content, and you support the pod. And anything else you need to know, hit up the website offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. aside from that, just be excellent to each other and have a lovely week, and I'll see you next time. Love you. Bye bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.